I'm VOA's Jeff Custer with this worldwide news update. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Monday North Korea and China are the biggest ongoing drivers, allowing Russia to carry out its war in Ukraine, and that security assurances will need to be part of any potential future negotiations to end the conflict. Speaking during a visit to South Korea Monday, Blinken said North Korean supplies of artillery, ammunition, and troops, along with Chinese support for Russia's military industrial base, are giving the Russian military the backing it needs to continue carrying out the fight it began with a full-scale invasion February of 2020.
In the last week of December, more than 1,000 North Korean forces were killed and or wounded in Kursk. Casualties of Russia's effort to redraw the border of a sovereign country, Ukraine, to do it by force, and a sign of the growing threat posed by heightened cooperation between revisionist authoritarians in Moscow and in Pyongyang.
Blinken said North Korea is already seeing a return on its involvement in the conflict in the form of Russian military equipment and training for North Korean troops. Israeli emergency services said three people were killed and seven others wounded when gunmen attacked a bus and car Monday in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The attack happened near the Palestinian town of Al Funduk. Israel's National Ambulance Service said two women in their 60s and a man in his 40s were pronounced dead at the scene. Violence has surged in the West Bank since Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack out of Gaza ignited the ongoing war there. During his briefing in South Korea Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Blinken, who will leave office in a little more than 2 weeks, said U.S. negotiators are still working with partners in the region to get a ceasefire deal in Gaza.
What we've seen in the last couple of weeks is a re-intensified engagement, including by Hamas, but we have yet to see agreement on the final points. So what I can tell you is this. We very much want to bring this over the finish line in the next 2 weeks, the time that we have remaining. And we will work every minute of every day of those 2 weeks to try to get that to happen.
This is VOA News. Sources close to the leader report Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, whose party is facing a predicted defeat in upcoming elections, is increasingly likely to announce his resignation, though he has reportedly not made a final decision. Reuters correspondent Ryan Brooks reports.
It marks the latest development in Canada's political landscape, following a report by the Globe and Mail newspaper earlier on Sunday that Trudeau was preparing to step down. The newspaper, citing three unnamed sources, reported that the exact timing of Trudeau's resignation announcement remains unclear. However, they expected an announcement before a key national caucus meeting on Wednesday. It remains unclear whether Trudeau will leave immediately or stay on as prime minister until a new leader is selected. One source told the newspaper that Trudeau has spoken with Finance Minister Dominic LeBlanc about stepping in as interim leader and prime minister. That move might not work if LeBlanc plans to run for the position himself.
That was Reuters correspondent Ryan Brooks reporting. The U.S. Congress plans to convene Monday in D.C. to certify the 2024 election results for U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. January 6th is the date required by U.S. law for the election certification, and presiding over the process would be the person Trump defeated in the election, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. With the legacy of January 6, 2021, when a violent mob of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol, is hanging over Monday's proceedings as the candidate who then tried to overturn the previous election is legitimately returning to power this time. Speaking to Democratic members of Congress Sunday, U.S. President Joe Biden said it is important for all members of Congress to accept the choice of U.S. voters while never forgetting what happened in 2021.
January 6th, we gather to certify the results on a free and fair presidential election and ensure a peaceful transfer of power. It's a day that most of our history we took for granted, the 6th, but I hope we never take it for granted again.
Tightest national security is in place at the Capitol Monday, a stark reminder of what happened at the Capitol 4 years ago. Residents across much of the United States are in the grips of a disruptive winter storm that forecasters said could produce the heaviest snowfall in a decade. The northeastern Atlantic states prepared for a major blizzard that has already covered parts of the midwestern U.S. with heavy snow and dangerously low wind chills. National Weather Service forecaster Bob Orovec told the Associated Press for the eastern third of the U.S., getting around will be the biggest issue.
The ice is definitely going to be a big deal. There is a band of some significant icing expected from southeast Kansas, southern Missouri, southern Illinois, southern Indiana, into Kentucky. That's going to be to the south of the very heavy snow axis to the north. So any combination of icing on the ground and a combination of snow is going to be causing a lot of travel issues.
That wraps up this news update, but the world and the news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I believe that his faith has a lot to do with it, but also his personal character, his family legacy. He did not come from a major or prominent family.
That was Naheed Awad, the National Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, speaking about the late President Jimmy Carter. Details coming up. Also, Congress votes today to certify the 2024 election victory of President-elect Donald Trump. And Cameroon seizes hundreds of weapons bound for the militant group Boko Haram. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Today, U.S. lawmakers will gather for a joint session of Congress to certify Donald Trump's presidential election win, a procedure that happens every 4 years after the vote and 2 weeks before the president's inauguration. VOA's Anthony Labruto is on Capitol Hill monitoring the situation. Welcome to African News Tonight, Anthony.
Hi, hey, it's good to be with you.
So what exactly happens during this joint session of Congress?
So a lot of things happen really throughout the day. So the first step in this whole process is the U.S. House of Representatives and Senate first meet separately for a quick meeting, which is happening right about now. Then around 1 p.m. local time, both will reconvene in the House chamber to perform the actual certification process. So all these different voting certificates of each state are brought in boxes and then individually read aloud to do an official count. And so this is where that electoral college comes in that we've been reporting about throughout the actual election. So those votes from the states, each having a different number appointed, you know, based on different populations and so forth, it's their votes that are actually certified by Congress that then confirm that President-elect Donald Trump will assume office. And so presiding over that meeting, interestingly enough, will be Vice President Kamala Harris, who lost that election. And then so as a final act, when all the state electors are counted and confirmed by Congress and Senate, she is expected to then certify the whole 2024 election, confirming Donald Trump and J.D. Vance as the president and vice president.
So how has the procedure changed since the last one?
A lot of big things, particularly in the realm of security. So since the last joint meeting, as you'll remember, 4 years ago, the event in 2021 where supporters of Donald Trump had tried to object to the Electoral College counting and declare the 2020 election invalid, which then saw Joe Biden assume the presidency. You know, once that situation was initially under control, Congress resumed and then officially certified that election. And so fast forward to now, an attack in New Orleans happened last week. Former President Jimmy Carter's funeral will be happening later this week. Officials are worried about even a repeat of happening what happened in 2021. So officials have declared in D.C. This joint session to be a, quote, national security event, which is the highest security priority that can be issued for something like this. So this allows security officials to bring in greater numbers of police, National Guard. They're coming in today, surrounding the entire Capitol complex, which was in kilometers, is about a three-meter-high fence, extra security inside of the halls of Congress, inside the representatives' chamber, and you really, really can feel that something is kind of out of the ordinary here.
And lastly, Anthony, with votes being counted today, what are the next steps for Congress and the incoming Trump administration?
Absolutely. So Congress will spend the better part of the afternoon reading aloud those elector votes, Kamala Harris then confirming them. Once that's done, really the last big thing in this whole Democratic process is the inauguration. So that'll happen in exactly 2 weeks. So this will see the official ceremony where Donald Trump and J.D. Vance are sworn in by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court as President and Vice President of the United States. And so Biden's officially leave the White House, and the new administration will then get to work.
VOA's Anthony Labruto reporting from Capitol Hill. Thank you for your input, Anthony.
Absolutely. Thank you.
'24 was a year of conflict, with wars in Gaza and Ukraine claiming many thousands of lives. Africa also played its part with conflict in Sudan, ongoing rebel attacks in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, terrorism across the Sahel region, and civil strife in several countries, including Mozambique. Some analysts tell Darren Taylor the prospects of peace in 2025 are not good.
The United Nations projects 305 million people will require humanitarian assistance in 2025, many because of conflict and many in Africa. It says 400 million children live in war zones or are trying to flee them. Juan Chavez Gonzalez, an expert in humanitarian action at the UN, says it's becoming increasingly difficult to help victims of war.
Conflicts in places where colleagues are probably going to go deeper into, like in Sudan, Ukraine, Gaza, are incredibly deadly. And the needs are extremely complex, and the human condition is really on the edge of a precipice in many of these places. So delivering assistance in these highly volatile, insecure environments is not just an issue of whether we have enough resources. It's also operationally very, very complex.
During a recent online event presented by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Gonzalez said extreme weather events caused by climate change have made humanitarian assistance much harder. In Sudan, for example, the UN is helping refugees fleeing war, drought, and floods. This has worsened human suffering, with Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, the Sahel, and Somalia as some of the flashpoint areas. Jonathan Madjok, director of the Refugee and Forced Displacement Initiative at the Wilson Center, a research institute in Washington, D.C., says conflict and its causes have become increasingly complex, making wars hard to end.
Sudan, there are multiple players in there. More refugees are located now in urban areas than the traditional refugee camps. And that again become more of development challenges because people are living in cities. That is a policy focus that should switch from the traditional way where we view refugees as a temporary phenomenon living in the camp, for example, and they will return home tomorrow. That is not the issue now.
In the Sahel, he says, new terrorist groups are springing up all the time, joining the fight against government troops and Russian forces. Majok says most refugees are now hosted by low to middle income countries, which affects their economies. He says wealthier countries are no longer willing to take many asylum seekers. Majok expects this to continue in 2025. With the United States and European countries in particular enforcing legislation that makes it difficult for people to claim asylum. What's also changed recently, says Jochen Rieg of the Norwegian Refugee Council, is that many armed groups are not allowing aid into conflict zones.
Changes to the geopolitical dynamics and the rise of non-traditional actors, I think, is one key piece we're looking at, and we see these developments, especially in the Sahel, where our usual engagement to influence actors, to leverage, are not working any longer. Humanitarians are mostly the only international actor, so humanitarians are often being used as for political purposes.
Rieg says that as long as the world's primary means of ending conflict, the UN Security Council, remains divided, there's little hope of ending the world's wars in 2025. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Cameroon's military says it has seized several hundred weapons and combat uniforms that were being smuggled to a hideout of the Nigeria-based terrorist group Boko Haram. Officials say troops have been deployed in a bid to capture more weapons and prevent Boko Haram from rearming itself. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Cameroon government officials say long-barreled firearms, military uniforms, over 400 packets of tear gas and more than 100 gallons of oxidizing agents were seized from suspected Boko Haram members this week in Marwa, a northern town near the Central African country's border with Nigeria and Chad. The military says the oxidizing agents are used by Boko Haram terrorists to produce explosives. The governor of Cameroon's far north region, Mijiyawa Bakari says the weapons were being smuggled to Nigeria's Sambisa Forest, a Boko Haram stronghold. Bakari says he is very thankful to the Cameroon military for intercepting war weapons, combat uniforms and acids used to fabricate explosives destined for several Boko Haram groups in Sambisa, a forest which straddles the Nigerian-Cameroon border and is a hideout for members of the terror group. He says Boko Haram is rearming and recruiting members after it was weakened by troops of the Multinational Joint Task Force of the Lake Chad Basin, or MNGTF. MNGTF is made up of 11,000 troops from Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. Bakari told Cameroon State TV on Thursday that some of the weapons were smuggled through the Douala Sea port. He did not say how the weapons got to Douala, but said investigations have been opened to trace the origin of the weapons. Cameroon's military says some of the combat uniforms seized are similar to those used by its infantry and air force. Boko Haram fighters sometimes disguise themselves as government troops to deceive civilians before attacking communities for supplies, officials say. The government says civilians should help prevent Boko Haram from rearming and recruiting new members by reporting strangers in all border towns and villages to government troops. Chad's president, Mohamed Idriss Déby, in his New Year's message on Thursday, said several hundred fighters escaped Chad to neighboring countries when his troops launched Operation Haskanite. The operation's goal is to neutralize Boko Haram fighters who attacked and killed more than 40 Chadian government troops in the Lake Chad Basin in October. Maki Jean Emmanuel is a researcher on conflicts in the Lake Chad Basin and visiting lecturer at the University of N'Djamena. He says no country in the Lake Chad Basin can single-handedly defeat Boko Haram. Maki says MNGTF should be on alert because Boko Haram is infiltrating many villages where government troops do not have easy access, and recruiting new members, especially poor and unemployed youths, is taking place. He says the porous nature of the borders between Cameroon, Nigeria and Chad makes it possible for arms to be smuggled to villages where Boko Haram fighters are hiding. Cameroon says several dozen people caught smuggling the weapons were arrested, but has given no details on whether they are Cameroonians, Nigerians or Chadians. Over 40,000 people have been killed and 3 million have fled their homes in Nigeria, Cameroon, Niger and Chad since 2009, when fighting between Nigerian government troops and Boko Haram militants degenerated into an armed conflict and gradually spread to neighboring countries. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE, the largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization in the U.S., says former President Jimmy Carter was a champion for many just causes, including Palestinian freedom, and was a friend of the Muslim community. CARE National Executive Director Nihad Awad spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi about the unique characteristics of the late president, who died a week ago at the age of 100.
I think it's important for us to recognize, acknowledge, and appreciate the legacy of those who are with us and those who pass. And former President Jimmy Carter was such a unique politician and world statesman that will be remembered for a long time for his courage, humility, and honesty, which is really a rare commodity these days. In particular for us, we witnessed him standing up for Palestinian rights and calling the Israeli state basically an apartheid state, something that has been felt and known all around the world among day-to-day people, politicians, researchers, human rights organizations, but not many who have the courage are willing to say that. And that cost him a lot of attacks, ridicule from the pro-Israel organizations and politicians.
In 2014, the late President Carter delivered a keynote address at the Islamic Society of North America's annual convention, and you described him in your statement as a friend of the Muslim community. What made the late president a unique friend to the Muslim Americans?
The Muslim community as a minority always hopes that statespeople and politicians and leaders of our nation would always stand by minorities who are usually the subject of discrimination, isolation, and stigmatization. So the poor people, oppressed people, and he spent the rest of his life after the presidency in building homes for the poor people. He volunteered for Habitat for Humanity, and because of his universal reach and influence, was able to make it a prominent and known organization around the world. So I believe his character, his honesty, his humility was unique in a time and a world where this should be the norm. When you are a universal or international leader, these should be some of the characteristics that make you such a leader. However, former President Carter, I think he was an outlier, and he was unique, an exception to what we see today.
Kerr said in its statement that President Carter was a humanitarian role model. Did that role model stem from his spirituality or his deep conviction of equality for all people and his call for people to be kind to one another?
I think that the answer is all of the above. Definitely his faith contributed a lot to his understanding and his behavior and his conduct towards people. Maybe his humble beginning and his personal devotion to his wife and people who need to be uplifted at home and around the world. For him, also being a president who has seen a lot, has seen it all, to utilize his visibility, access, and reach to devote it to humanitarian and just causes is something only a person of faith and a person who appreciates what other people and other nations go through. It sets him apart. I believe that his faith has a lot to do with it, but also his personal character, his family legacy. He did not come from a major or prominent family like others. So you can see that his legacy all along since his childhood runs through his family is based on honesty, hard work, simplicity, and devotion.
Ceremonies to honor former President Carter will begin tomorrow in his home state of Georgia. Then his body will be brought to Washington to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol on Tuesday. VOA will provide coverage of the ceremonies. Check voaafrica.com and voanews.com. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA and radio TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. In Kenya, news media and rights groups say four young men who disappeared last month in a spate of abductions of government critics were freed today. The kidnappings have dominated news and political discussion in recent weeks, with at least six young men disappearing in late December. The French news agency AFP reports that at least two were taken after posting AI-generated images of President William Ruto in a coffin. The Kenya National Commission on Human Rights has recorded 82 abduction cases since youth-led protests broke out last June, with 29 still missing. The police have denied involvement in abductions, but President Ruto has vowed to stop the abductions. China's top diplomat began his annual New Year tour of Africa on Sunday. Reuters reports that Foreign Minister Wang Yi will visit Namibia, the Republic of Congo, Chad, and Nigeria. Reuters News says Wang's trip through to Saturday comes as the world's number two economy ramps up its financial support of the debt-laden continent and looks to strike more critical minerals deals and find markets to absorb its exports. Wang's decision to visit the Republic of Congo comes as the country this year takes over as co-chair of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation Group, which sets the agenda for China-Africa relations. Observers say it points to China's commitment to implementing the outcomes of last year's summit, where China pledged $51 billion in fresh financial assistance. Time now for our sports roundup. We have VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Baro to brief us on everything that happened in sports over the weekend. Thanks for being with us, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Hayes.
So in some football news, over the weekend, the English Premier League had some games with huge implications. Tell us more about it.
Yes, at this current moment, Liverpool are at top of the league. So every single game for those teams that are trying to chase, every game is monumental. Interestingly enough, the two teams that should have capitalized on a moment this weekend, Arsenal and Chelsea, both ended up drawing. So for them, this is a missed opportunity. Liverpool rarely drops points, and they had a huge clash against Manchester United. Funny enough, Manchester United somehow always plays at their best when they play against Liverpool. It was a very exciting game. The game ended up 2-2. Both teams really deserved to win it. So I think that was a fair result for how that game played out. As mentioned, Arsenal ends up drawing against Brighton 1-1. Controversial penalty. I've personally never seen a penalty given on a headbutt situation in all my years of watching the game. But somehow, when you watch Arsenal, there's always something new that happens when it comes to the refs. So with that being said, Chelsea also were able to get a draw against Crystal Palace late, very late for Crystal Palace to knock some points off of Chelsea as well. So those were the games.
Okay, and then now in boxing news, Oleksandr Usyk beats Tyson Fury for a second time. Boxing fans ask, who can challenge Usyk at heavyweight?
Interestingly enough, Tyson Fury loses to Usyk twice. Daniel Dubois, potentially now with him being a champ as well, could go for a rematch. That's the only one that makes sense. He beat Anthony Joshua twice already. Deontay Wilder wouldn't make sense for Usyk, considering that he's mainly a one-hit type of puncher, and Usyk really is very clinical in how he does it. So the only one I see is Daniel Dubois, in form that he is right now, could potentially give Usyk a challenge. If not, maybe Usyk just retires at the top.
And going on to basketball, Mokbil, in the NBA, who have been the hottest teams at the top of the new year?
Funny enough, it keeps seeming like this is a redundant conversation we keep having at the top. The Cleveland Cavaliers and the Oklahoma City Thunder are both at the top. They are currently, Oklahoma City Thunder have a 15-game unbeaten streak currently. So I think they are currently the hottest team in the NBA. They have 30 wins and only 5 losses. The Cleveland Cavaliers have 31 wins and 4 losses. So they're right neck and neck. I think those are the top teams right now.
VOA sports analyst Mokbilia Baro, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me. VOA.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.